This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you.
Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Okay, I'm in New York again. I'm with Mark Zagger. I've actually wanted to... I don't come up here very often. I've wanted to do an interview for a long time, and I've had several requests if I get around you to do the interview. So why don't you just kind of go, who are you, where you're from, just so someone kind of knows who you are if they don't know who you are.
Okay.
It's Mark Zagger. I'm out of Cazenovia, New York, which is about an hour from where we sit here. It's west. It's kind of south of Syracuse and kind of rolling agricultural country. Beautiful, big dairy farms, nice canine country. I'm originally from Ohio. I started trapping in 1976. And after I got out of college, I moved to Pennsylvania and thought I was a hotshot fox trapper in PA. Never caught a coyote. And I moved to New York in 1987 and started trapping that first year and caught my first coyotes in 1987 and kind of went from there. I trap for a very short time every year. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm kind of a 3 weeks and done guy. I start October 25th and go right through the beginning of our deer gun season. And in those 3 weeks, you know, I've been doing 125 to 150 coyotes. My best year was 183 coyotes, which was about 4 years ago, but I caught 30 of those in January. We had a anomaly of a winter with no snow up here, which never happens. You know, this is country where we get lake effect snow, and that's a lot of the reason I think that I kind of stick out up here, because there's not a lot of big number coyote guys up here. Mm-hmm. and the weather's part of it, you know.
Well, before I ask you what I was getting to ask you, how did you get starting? I'm always interested in how did someone actually start trapping?
You know, it's a typical story. One of my best friends, Rod, he called me one day and he says, "Hey, I caught a mink in a trap." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Come over and see it." So this is, like I said, it was probably 1975 because I started in 76. So I went over to his house, and him and his dad had found, at the time I didn't know what it was, they'd found a number 3 Victor jump hanging in a tree somewhere, and his dad says, "That's a trap." I mean, we're talking, we were 10 years old, and his dad, you know, was never a trapper, but he told him, you know, find a log where it crosses a creek and hatch it out of bed and put some moss in and put this trap in. So my buddy Rod did that with a number 3 Victor jump, and what he thought,
I guarantee the mink didn't get away.
Well, and what's funny was, even at that age, I was pretty well versed on animal species, and as soon as I saw it, I knew it wasn't a mink. It was actually a long-tailed weasel.
And oh, really?
It was brown with a white belly, yeah. And it was kind of bared right in that number 3. And I don't know, it just tripped a trigger with me. And that next year, we bought a couple conibears bears and started setting them for muskrats and things like that. I couldn't even set the trap. My older brother Michael used to set the conibears bears for me at my house. And I'd carry them back in the woods and set them, or the cricks, and God forbid if they snapped off, because I couldn't reset them, you know. And I said, well, this doesn't work. I better learn how to set these myself. Mm-hmm. So I caught my first muskrat that year, 1976, and got the bug. And this is right when the fur boom starting to crank, right? And everybody in the world was trapping. Every kid in school was trapping. My dad and grandfather, hunters, but not trappers. I was first generation in the Zagger family, if you will. But and then, you know, I started getting the magazines and the Trapper back when Tom Krause was editor and all that stuff, and I wanted to start trapping fox. I caught my first red fox in 1978, and here I am.
Do you remember how you caught it?
Oh gosh, yeah. I can't tell you my wife's birthday or anniversary date, but I can tell you about that red fox in 1978. I mean, you couldn't write a more, you know, stereotypical thing. Angle iron steak, number 2 Victor square jaw, Hobbaker's ready red urine in a dirt hole. And in hindsight, it was probably a pretty good location. Where I lived in Ohio is kind of flat ground, and there was this farm where I trapped. There was one really noticeable knob where if you climbed up on top of this knob, you could see forever. And it was as far as Ohio forever. Mm-hmm. And it was really a unique feature, you know, in hindsight. And I set one trap up on top of that and caught a red fox my first night. It was a pup. And my brother was with me, and I was young. I was 11 or 12 years old, and I told my brother, we have to walk up to it and tap it and step on it. And my brother, because he was as nervous as I was, I think he killed it with the tap of the trowel. Because we were scared.
Adrenaline was flowing.
Yeah, I think it was dead on the first swing. I don't think we had to step on it. But boy, you know, what a day that was. And I remember it. I wouldn't say I remember it like it was yesterday, but that was the impetus for me getting into the canine side, you know. I've always trapped beaver and muskrats and things like that on the side, but the canines were always the obsession.
Now, when did y'all just kind of like muscle through it, or did you start reading books, or did you have a mentor of some kind?
No mentor at all, and that was back when everybody was tight-lipped, right? And, you know, I started getting that magazine, The Trapper, and we've got this great picture of me back in 1979 or 80, and it's Christmas morning, and I have straight hair, and back then, people used to get the permanence in their hair, you know? And there's a picture of me, skinny kid, probably in 10th grade, and it's Christmas morning. I've got my hair curly and look like a goof, and there I am reading Dynamite Fox Trapping. It was and it's a picture, and all our family's around. Everybody's like looking at the camera, and I'm reading Dynamite Fox Trapping. So I started probably, compared to my buddies, my peers at the time, I probably jumped right into it and wanted to get better and wanted to learn. And again, this is way before internets or DVDs or videos. So there was no one really in my area that I could even go to. The fur buyer, a guy named Leonard Luoma, you know, he was tight-lipped. You know, he wouldn't tell you anything. And so we used to go to conventions and try to learn some things. And probably the first thing I did that went down the road of any kind of instruction, do you remember they used to have those traveling seminars, and
Milligan and Blackie, and
that's exactly who it was. Mm-hmm. So I went to a seminar. Where I grew up in Ohio was on the border of PA and Ohio, about 7 miles, and there was one of those traveling seminars came through. It was Ray Milligan, Carol Black, and Jeff Kuhn Richter, mm-hmm. however you say his name. So that was probably 80-81 that I went to that, and with a bunch of other guys, and I was that little snot-nosed kid, you know, in the front row trying to learn, and I think it helped a lot, but it was more of a trial and error thing, you know, like you said, muscling through it, you know. I wasn't afraid to try it, and I wasn't afraid to try to set a lot of traps, and I think that was, you know, the game of percentages that was even kicking in back then, you know, as far as I wasn't just setting two fox trap. I was trying to set a couple dozen compared to my buddies, and I muscled through it, and I started catching them, you know.
What when you look back of that, because you seem to have a good memory of it, when did location start clicking to you?
You know, I think it started clicking as far as me understanding it, you know, when I moved to Pennsylvania. You know, I think in Ohio, because I wasn't driving when I first started. I had a very limited mm-hmm. number of places to set, and I did back then what I don't do now, where I was probably setting every single location that looked like something out of the books, you know, every hedgerow, every crop change type thing, and a lot of, you know, some of it was on my bicycle. But when I moved to Pennsylvania and actually started catching coyotes or red fox in numbers, I think that was along the lines where it finally got to the point where, you may remember this about yourself, I was, you know, I grew up in the day of everybody being paranoid about human odor and scent, mm-hmm. and wearing weight. You know, we used to wear hip boots at the sets, kneeling, and different set of boots to gas up and all that crazy stuff, you know. And I remember when I started thinking, I set a trap, and I remember actually resonating with me that I'm going to catch something. Not will I catch something, but I'm going to. And I, that confidence, I think, was a game changer. And I think everybody works towards that, eventually gets to that point, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of guys remember when that happened. And I remember even when it went backwards when I moved to New York with coyotes. I didn't have a lot of confidence with it, and then there was a time 5-6 years after I was here and I was catching them in better numbers than most that I was like, you know, this confidence, the best lure I have, you know, kind of a thought process.
I do think it. You know, I was kind of lucky, and I'm an optimist by nature. A friend of mine says, if I was a kid and he threw me in a stall of horse crap, I would just be happy because I know my pony's in there.
Right.
You know, that's just my personality. And the first trap I ever set held a male marten.
Wow.
So that's what I remember in Alaska. And then I think it was like 3 weeks, I didn't catch nothing. Yeah. But every set I went to, I just automatically learned it. And then when I know exactly what you're saying. I came back, I was catching a bunch of fur, and then I was doing a big control 4-year job for a county, and somewhere in there, what you're talking about clicked. I mean, everything started making a lot more sense, and you just knew. And it's like when you knew, they knew.
Right.
And it doesn't make sense. You know, I'm not really into the hippie type of whatever all that is, but there's something to that.
I tell you, you know, when I was in college, I had a run at wildlife biology for a while, and I didn't stick with it. But that being said, I used to take care of these fox and coyotes while I was in college at this biology station, and we were doing a study on pheromones, and and what they mean to canines and what they mean to dogs. And now I remember my I don't know if this makes any sense, and this is kind of voodoo crazy talk, I think, sometimes, but I think there's a little bit to it. You know, people will tell you that a dog can sense when you're afraid of them, you know, from a distance.
Yes.
And it's not just your body language. You're emitting some kind of stink that it resonates with them or registers with them. And this is really crazy, but I am absolutely convinced I used to think about this a lot. When I'm sitting there making a set and I'm nervous and jerky and I'm worried about sweat and I'm worried about human odor and I'm worried about every little thing, I think I'm putting a bad vibe out there, as dumb as this sounds. And I don't know if it's pheromones or what, but I think when you just walk in and kneel down and go and start digging and rocking and rolling, and you're confident. It's crazy talk, I know, but I think there could be something to that. You're just putting out a different vibe, you know. I'm not saying that's has anything to do with it, but I think it's more of a mindset with me, you know.
I don't know what it is. I do believe when I do a lot of instruction, especially down in Texas, the first couple of days the guys are nervous. Yeah. You know, they're in a weird place. You know, we got them armed to the teeth because we're on the border and all that. And it's just so strange to be in South Texas coming from, like, New York.
Right.
And they're nervous of the instructors, are nervous of is my other partner going to laugh at me, yada, yada, yada. But when they calm down, that's when it starts working better for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was out at O'Gorman's, one of the biggest things that really... You know, people always say, what did you learn out of O'Gorman? And it wasn't so much how to catch animals to me. It was how did he think when he ran his line? And that was a big deal. But whenever he set a trap and he was talking about it, it was never, if one comes through. It's like, when he comes through, he is going to do this, and that's the reason I'm doing that, and I'm going to catch him.
Right.
Every single set we put in his mind was a dead coyote.
Right.
No question whatsoever. You know, and it was kind of like in the military thing we always used to say was smooth is fast. And he was very smooth and he was very fast.
Right.
But, you know, you get someone that's nervous and tries to be fast, they look like, you know, you just shot them up with cocaine and they're bouncing all over the place. And I think you're right then.
Well, and we share that. You know, I went out to Broadus, Montana myself. I guess it was 88, 89 range, you know. So I wouldn't mind going again. I think the more experience you have under your belt, I think it registers a little better with you, you know. If you went out there and you hadn't caught any, I think there'd be too much, you know. Mm-hmm. It probably happens with you too, given instructions now. You probably be, not that you, I'm sure there's the old adage about you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but... You know, I think if you have some experience under your belt, the things that you would show somebody or the things that Craig showed me would make more sense. You know?
Well, I went twice, and the second time was totally different because I was looking at things. My questions were different.
Yeah.
So his responses were different.
Right.
And it was exactly what I needed to hear at that time.
Right.
You know, and it was, you know, a lot different. And we got into a lot of what he calls catching tricky coyotes, mm-hmm. which... I kept playing around with that, and it was a game changer to me. Then when I started using the cameras, I was like, you know, that old man in Montana knew what he was talking about.
Right.
He really did.
Yeah. It was funny because when I was riding with him, you know, I was out there for 2 days, and you go out there, you're prepared to ask a million questions, and while you're there, you're asking a million questions, but... I was running out, and we're driving. It's like noon on the second day. He's like, "What else you got?" He was like forcing me to ask.
He looks
questions.
Over those glasses and looks down at you and goes, "Next question."
Yeah, what else you got? You know, and I'm like, "Wow, I think I've asked everything, but I'll come up with something." You know, he's an intimidating fella. You know, but when I went out there, it was at the time when I know people used to stay there and go into the house and everything, and I was out there waiting in the driveway. He come walking out. I was in front of his house there and come out with that hat. I'm like, "Holy cow, look at this guy!"
And I've kidded him about this. The first time I went out there, he met at his house. You don't do that anymore.
Right.
And the way, and I know it's set up. I mean, it has to be set up the way this is. You can see him the way his cabin, if it was finished when you were out there, and you could see through that front window.
Yep.
He'd be at the breakfast table, and he'd have that hat on. When you'd pull up, the only place you could pull up was right in front of the window.
That's right.
And you would go in, you'd meet Dana, and, you know, she'd, how you doing, this and another, let me introduce you to Craig. And you would go around, Craig would be at the table, and he would wait till you got like from me to you, almost in personal space to shake his hand, that's when he'd unfold that 6'6" body within 3'3" cowboy boots and that Stetson. He's 7 feet tall. I'm not a small guy. Right. I'm not used to looking up. And it's kind of like, holy cow.
Exactly. Yeah.
And now he does it where he picks you up at 4:30 in the morning. And the second time I was out there, it's foggy every morning out there. You know, we don't have, like, you get more fog here than we do at home. That's not a normal thing for us. And he picks you up, well, he's on that quiet road, and he says, you know, I'm leaving at 4:35, so you can be here or not. You're a grown man. And you hear that diesel truck pinging down the road, and it's actually eerie.
Here he comes.
And then he's got all them lights, and they're all on. So when he's come down that little driveway through all those trees, you're sitting on the front porch, and it's kind of like this manifestation is coming towards you, you know. And then he stops, and he sits in there for about a minute till he gets out, you know. And I know it's planned. I mean, I know it's planned the way he does that. And I was like, you know, he thinks of everything.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And that's a little bit of marketing, too, probably. Like, wow, you know, look at this. Like, almost starting a Vegas show. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. But no, one of his proteges, you know, Gary Strader?
Mm-hmm.
Gary's from New York and moved out to Montana and kind of took over some of the area. Or he was in just a little northeast of Craig. And I went out there with him a few times. And he was the one that got me on the dogs because I have two Irish Terriers, but one of them's half Dorn from Craig's line there. So one of the things, you know, I am, as far as here in the Northeast, there's not very many guys that use dogs on the line. And I think a lot of guys think it's more of a Western thing. I guess it is, but that's something I do that's a little different. But I got it, you know, I ended up getting that through, you know, third person from Gary through Craig, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So my dogs are getting to be 14 and 12, so starting to think about more, you know. But I enjoyed going out there. And the challenge for me is probably the same as a lot of guys in the East. It's just such different country out there. So
it's hard to
translate his locations and such to what we have here, but it's like you said, it's the mindset that you get from him. And the,
are you saying you don't have ridgebacks with the bowls with the petrified wood and no. The 20 years of dead cow bones to, as a draw station?
Nothing, no. Even close, you know. And out here, you know, it's amazing to me when I've trapped out west, you know, everything out there lasts forever, whether it's sign, you know, turds, and you know, the wind obviously plays havoc on it. But around here, you dig a trap bed in this ground here and you come back next year, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Grew back, you know. The soil's constantly moving, and there's so much moisture out here. Probably same as Tennessee, and nothing lasts forever. You're lucky to find a cable stake from last year if you,
right.
You know, if you leave them in. The indentation is gone unless you dig a really deep bed in that. And those Charlie Robbins style dirt holes, you know, sometimes they'll still last. But I started throwing some rocks in there every now and then if I knew it was a spot I was going to set next year. But I just kind of gave up trying. Around here, everything just goes back to, or you set in a hayfield this year and you come in next year and it's a corn lot.
Mm-hmm.
Or yeah. Soybeans, you know, just constantly moving around. But different. But you still, how can you not learn something from a guy like that? And I've always, I've taken lessons from the Leggetts. And
here, I have too.
Yeah, and in my backyard here. And then just recently, I thought I better do this because he's not going to be around forever. And I did it more for probably the experience. But I rode with Johnny Thorpe a couple years ago. And that was fun. You know, it was just more interesting. And he was picking my brain about coyotes, and I was telling him all about, or he was telling me about mink and Fisher and such. But, and you know, the reason I do that, one of the standing jokes around here with my guys or people I know or even on the internet is, I just think that someday I'm going to turn into this gentleman mink trapper. You know, you know, drive around with a cup of coffee in my hand and check weasel boxes and mink. And because, you know, frankly, physically, you know, I don't know that I can do the 150 mm-hmm. coyotes forever, you know, because I'm skinning them all myself. And even though I have a nice setup with a power puller and, you know, fur tumblers and everything, I have a nice shop. It's just, you know, there's going to be a time where I'm gonna be like, yeah, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, and mink just intrigued the heck out of me. And I could see taking my same focus and drive on coyotes and applying it to mink, you know, and really enjoying that. And I'm not saying that's not hard work, but I think the nice thing about a mink or a muskrat is if I get home tonight and my wife Gina has plans for us or, you know, something happens, and I could just throw them in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
You have 12 coyotes. You don't have a lot of options.
Not unless you got a big walk-in.
Yeah, which I do not. So you got to peel them son of a guns, you know? So, but, you know, that's down the road. But I keep saying that, and I keep dabbling, and I keep getting rigged up for mink, but I just keep coming back to the coyotes.
Yeah. I've got a funny story about Johnny. I went up and took instruction for 4 days, and I was curious how he does his coyotes in the mountains and that, and we're doing cats. I've caught a few cats. So, you know, he's showing me his thing and this, that, and the other. Well, this was about the same time that I think it's Steve Woods is his name, is coming out with expand pans and all that, and Johnny, he might not be able to today, but then he could walk me to death. Yeah. I mean, he was just used to it. Cowboy boots going up slick leaves and rocks and like a goat.
Yeah.
You know, my big butt's like, you know, but you can't do that in front of Johnny, so you just suck it up, you know. And he's got this great big rock, and he's showing me how he sets up against stuff, kind of just a basic blind thing. And I asked him, I said, have you ever tried those exposed pans that you know, everybody's talking about now? And he's making a set, and he's working down there, and he had a great big old, you know, leather cowboy hat on, so you really can't see him. And he's down there, and he just stops. And he sits there, probably 20, 30 seconds. I mean, and that was, you know, you're kind of like, principal just got mad about something. You don't know what it is. And right. He stops. And he stands up, and, you know, me and Johnny's on different height levels, big time.
Yep.
And he looks up where he can, I mean, he's right up against me. He looks up, tilts that hat back, and he gets that little gnarled finger right there, and he goes, that was an amateur thing to ask, and I never want to hear that come out of your mouth again. You cover traps. And he went back down to work, and I was like, whoa, to this day, I cannot try an exposed trap. I played a little bit, but that's all I see is that little finger.
Isn't that funny?
Calling me an amateur for even thinking about that. And I was like, wow.
You know, it might have been the same rocks. The story that, and I came out of there with it, just, it was a good experience. But he drove me up the top of this hill, and we were along this beaver flow, and these big, huge boulders were
huge.
Right along the edge of that swamp. And he said, I've been catching cats here for 40 years and all that stuff. And when I walked in, I saw it. As soon as I saw the pinch points between the rocks and everything. So it was one of the last places we were stopping that day. And he was telling me about the cats. So we go walking up there, and in the dirt next to the boulder, there's a set of cat tracks. And you should have seen the smile on his face. And what I remember about it, thinking, you know, you're always a trapper, and you still want to see those tracks, and mm-hmm. you want to see it. And it's almost like he couldn't have planned it any better. He's telling me there's cat. But I think he was just happy to see those cat tracks in that spot that he's been catching them forever. It's still, you know, it's still a possible producer for him. Because, you know, every year, every day may be his last. And, you know, mm-hmm. it was like a perfect ending to a good day with him. I enjoyed it, you know. And but he's as simple as they come when it comes to his approach. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, he doesn't even use... I thought he was going to be showing me some running poles and things like that, but that's only going to catch a fisher. So he wants to set a number two bridger on, or Northwoods or bridger, and catch every animal that comes through. A raccoon, gray fox, fisher, coyote, and it's pretty basic, but it'd be like anything. Once you get it set up and just do it in numbers, it's going to produce, you know.
Well, I think Johnny's an example of, if you understand your terrain and the animals and their movements, you can really simplify and still catch.
Yeah.
You know, and it's... Because if you went out to Johnny expecting, you know, mastery of techniques, it's not there.
No.
But he does know animals.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it's a heel stomp in the bank with a trap in the water and a squirt, a hole with his finger, and down the road, you know, and barely tying off to a root or maybe a drag, you know, really fast and simple. Which, you know, there's two extremes in all this, you know, and you can see the value in going back to that simplicity.
Well, I got tickled at him. The first place he took me, he drove me somewhere, and it he may take everybody on the same route, possibly. And it was doing coyotes the first day. And we pulled off the side of the road, and you can see a hiking trail that the hunters use. Okay. And it's kind of open right there at the road, just a little bit, only like 4 or 5 feet in. It gets thick, and you see that trail. And he's got his cans he hangs to the left-hand side.
Yep.
Okay. And he goes... Okay, big boy, you catch a coyote. Show me how you'd catch this coyote. And so I put a set in. And he looks at me. He goes, you can't put that trap there. And I'm like, well, why not? He said, somebody's going to steal it. And I'm like, well, they may. I said, but that's part of the reason I use the drags. And he goes, but they're going to steal it. And I'm like, Johnny, I've learned a long time ago, I don't worry about that. I can set more traps than they want to pick up and tote off. So eventually I'm going to win that game.
That's right.
And he just kind of shook his head and he goes, well, I'm not putting my trap there. I'll show you where I'm going to put the trap. And it was just, it was a different philosophy at the time.
Right.
You know, of, so you're kind of known now as the pipe dream. I mean, that's kind of what everybody talks about. And I caught like the last 5 minutes of your demo and,
oh, good.
And, I did get tickled at your buddies. I was trying to figure out how to, everybody was telling everybody to ask questions to try to embarrass you or trick you up, but yeah. None of them had the nerve to actually say it out loud.
Yeah. They, you know, they, these guys, buddies of mine come to my demos and like the bus chops, but like we all do. And I do the same thing back to them, but, yeah, you know, since you only saw the last 5 minutes, I went through kind of the evolution of that and how it came about. And, you know, using a pipe for canines is probably nothing new, or even a receptacle like that. What I call the pipe dream set is it's a number of items working in concert together. It's the pipe driven into the ground, but it's also the way I bed my trap, no dirt, steel screen or aluminum cover, hammer bedding method, and then just covering it with grass clippings. And in New York, like I talked about, you know, even in October, you know, it's not uncommon for us to have snow on Halloween, and we get rain, a lot of rain here, and freeze thaw is something that starts from day one with us. You know, I used to use wax dirt from day one just because I knew it was going to freeze, and that's an expensive,
that's a lot of work,
it's a lot of work, and it's an expense, and it's weight and all those different things. So I, for years I was using the T-bone sets, and I still do, and then I started using bamboo in a similar fashion, just like you'd use a grub steak or a grab and die steak, and they just weren't durable enough. And then the business that I'm in, we build communication towers for cell phone companies, public safety, Homeland Security. If this county was building a new 911 system, we would do all that work. We do the real estate work and such, but we have electrical contractors that are employed by us. And one day I was at one of our job sites, and they'd ran a piece of Schedule 40 conduit across the road and ran an extension cord underneath it. And I said, "What's the purpose of that?" And they said, "Well, that conduit's pretty durable. You can drive a truck over it and it won't break." I'm like, "Really?" And he said, "We don't normally do that, but then there's all these cutoffs there." And I still had a little bit of a raccoon trapper mentality. I'm like, "Man, I'll take all those pipes and use them for the pipe sets that everybody else uses, you know." And then they were just sitting there the one day, and I thought, "Man, why can't I use that for coyotes? You know, why not? What am I worried about? What am I thinking here?" So I started using them in place of my T-bones, same exact set, except at the grass clump, instead of a T-bone, I was pounding in these pieces of conduit. And they're about 10 inches long and 3/4 inch inside diameter, or an inch inside diameter. And I pound them in at a slight angle, maybe an 80 degree angle, and then I'm just bedding my trap in front of it, 8, 9, 10 inches out, pan center. And I'm covering the trap with grass clippings. But I used to, you know, here in New York, you could set in corn lots, you can set in soybean fields, you can set in hay fields. And years ago, I used to avoid hay fields, and that it's hard to do up here. But I used to like to, set in dirt because I thought I could blend my sets in better. I liked the way it looked. And now I'm the opposite. I rarely set in a cornfield. I mean, more purely because of muddy coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just get to be a sloppy mess. That can still happen in sod fields, but not as much. So this set really shines in that type of a, in that kind of a field. And so I dig a very small trap bed. I use big traps. I use Jakes and Sterlings, and I do use some KBs. But that Jake trap is perfect to cut a really nice, tight, square bed. And the thing that I do a little different, I guess, is I don't put that trap down at the bottom. I dig that bed deep, probably 3 or 4 inches. And then because I dig my bed so small, on top of the ground with my hammer, I do two swings each, and I make these little indentations at 3 and 9,
mm-hmm.
and that's where my lever set. So my trap is probably countersunk, maybe an inch and a half below surface. And if you know anything about the Jake trap, those levers kind of angle up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So here's your sod, and you know, here's your levers, and my trap's here, and I have a little bit of a drop, you know, maybe an inch and a half. Then I put my steel screen on there, and the steel screen serves a number of purposes. The main thing it serves in this set is to support my material. If you try to make this with wax paper, if you try to make it without a pan cover after your first rain, it just doesn't look right. And I'm not saying you can see the trap. I mean, it's just the outline of the trap, and I just don't like the way it looks. And I don't like steel screen. I think it's just another thing that you got
to
do.
To get you into big pans, brother, then your steel screen is on the trap all the time.
I got to tell you, people have been talking to me about that. You know, why not just make it a big pan and I think it would work great. I really do. And so then I cover it with, you know, grass that I've dried in the summer, and I get a couple yards of haylage from my dairy farmers, and I dry it in my yard, and it's just grass clippings. It's hay, but I think it looks better. It blends into a hay field, I think, a little better than the grass clippings from my yard, you know. Mm-hmm. And I dry them in onion bags up in the loft of my barn, and it's so easy and fast. I'm finding myself not wanting to dig any holes anymore. I'm getting lazy. And I'm having, you know, I haven't been confident enough to give up on the dirt holes and the T-bones and the grass tufts at my dog show, because I'm setting my ways a little bit. But when I first started doing this pipe thing about 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing maybe 10 or 15%. And last year, easy, 50, 60% of my sets for that. And I see myself just gradually going that way all the time. Mm-hmm. And I got the big 36-volt cordless. I mean, that's easy to dig a dirt hole, but in this rocky ground that we have around here, it'll still spin you around. You got to be paying attention. It'll break your wrist if it locks up and flips you around, you know. So, but those, and that conduit is amazingly durable. I pound it into frozen ground, really hard ground, and guys are doing a lot of different things with it. Since I came out of that article last year, I can't begin to tell you how many people have called me or emailed me or PM'd me around the country. And the guys are just doing different things with it, you know. Mm-hmm. Tracy Truman out in Las Vegas, who's a very good canine and cat trapper, he says, I never thought about using it. He's pounding them in between rock crevices, you know, and just using it as a lure receptacle. So it's, again, what Craig always say, it's new to them. It's new to that guy. You know, mm-hmm. everybody reinvents something. I think what I came out with, I've never seen that all together. You know, what I just told you with the screen and the grass and the thing. Maybe someone's done it, I'm not sure, and it doesn't really matter. I shared something, and it seems to be resonating with people, you know.
So. Well, it's kind of like the portable pocket. I got the original portable pocket from LT Gray in Ohio, or Anthony Wolfsong, depending on how you know him.
Yeah.
And he was using that for coons back in the 80s. And then he just gave me some, and I used them, you know, off and on, but then I got so sick of being in rain, I was like, these got to work somehow.
Yeah.
And over trial and error, I can use those pipes, now it's a whole total system for me, and it made my trapping easy.
Right.
You know, and it's, and the thing I like about the portable pocket, people don't believe me when I say this, but I can literally set that system up to catch a coyote. And then I can take that same system and go catch an otter. Then I can take that same system and go catch a raccoon or a muskrat or a mink or a fox.
Right.
And all I'm not going to have now is that system. And I'm just presenting it different.
Yeah.
And I don't carry a shovel anymore. You know, and my thing is, it's funny you're saying this stuff because because of the stuff that I do on the internet, a lot of new trappers, I'm having trouble with mud. First question you need to ask is, what is mud? It's raining dirt. You can't stop it from raining. Quit using dirt. Probably, you know, it's fixed now if you don't have the dirt in there. Well, you've got to bed it in dirt. No, you don't have to bed it in dirt. And it seems like what's happening to you is what you've noticed is the less you've got to remake stuff because of the weather, you're catching coyotes that most people won't catch because all their traps are out of commission.
Correct. You know, I talk to a lot of these guys. You know, you build your friendship pool, and you know, there's certain guys that are here even today that, you know, we talk almost every day when we're trapping, you know, with the phones and just driving. I don't stop. I'm just flying, you know, but, you know, we'll get a heavy rain. We'll get a gully washer, and I'll tell these guys, especially over the years when I was experimenting with this, and I wasn't really telling them about it because I wanted to see if it really worked the way I wanted it to. They're like, oh, I got to spend all day remaking sets, reluring and rebaiting sets. I'm like, really? Mm-hmm. And I joked yesterday during my demo, you know, I apologize to the bait and lure makers. I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth, you know. I use a lot of lure and bait once. You know, I'd lather them up right from the beginning. I'm not a one drop guy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm using a lot anyhow, whether it's in the pipe or dirt hole or whatever. And I don't go back, you know, but I'm trapping that. I with my 3 weeks, I might have traps on a farm for 7 or 8 days at the most. That's plenty. I mean, I don't need to re-lure bait in that time, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I on a remake or something like that, I will, but I don't touch them. You know, like I said, yes, I set it and forget it. And whether it's a dirt hole or whether it's pipe, I think these guys don't use enough to begin with, but they're using the wrong material to bed them in. I drive around after a heavy rain, and I just drive right on by, and things look just as good as when I left them there.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the real nice benefits of the set, I think, you know. The dirt holes aren't filling up. And even if that pipe fills up with water, that stinks still down inside there. And, you know, it's just going to keep doing that chimney effect, you know. I think it's got legs.
What are you looking for as far as coyote locations? What are you keying on now?
You know, I have permission to trap on over 100 farms, and most of them are dairy operations. Here in New York, we have a lot of big dairy country. And when I say big, not big like California where they're milking 8,000 head, but where I live, it's dairy farm after dairy farm after dairy farm. Therefore, as much as these guys won't admit it to you, they all have dead piles, you know, somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my trapping, if I can do it, is based on that as my focal point. And I may be out from it a ways, but it's travel ways into it and such. But if I'm not setting a dead pile or a calf dump, and I'm just location trapping, you know, I don't have a lot of cardinal rules, but I never set a one-way traveling, meaning one crop change, you know, never. I need the spokes on the wheel type thing happen. I need several things come together. A lot of blockages. I trap right up against big interstate highways, and they did a radio collar study up here in New York that I was involved with, and it was really interesting to see how these big highways are barriers for these coyotes, and when they were going underneath them, they were going underneath under the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
the dumb ones die, the smart ones,
that's right, they were going through culverts, but they were actually going underneath on a paved road. They were crossing there, but when you saw the studies of where these coyotes were, it was so obvious they were getting to this thing and bouncing along it and traveling. They weren't going under it very often. And I think they're territorial boundaries to some degree, but they're just tremendous blockages and barriers. And I have videos off my iPhone of, you know, semi-trucks going right behind coyotes and traps, and no one sees them. There's the fence, and then there's all that brush and grass and weeds, and they're hidden perfect. And I have a lot of farms that border, you know, those kind of highways. So, you know, probably if you rode with me and you saw some of my traditional locations, you'd think I was red fox trapping. It's some pretty basic, wide open, you know, farm fields with a lot of stuff coming together. We have a lot of water here in New York, so we've got a lot of ditches and creeks and
mm-hmm.
and a lot of culverts, a lot of bridge locations. These bridges, if I can find a bridge with two or three crop changes coming together, another hedgerow or something, that's bingo. You know, they just seem to go out of the way to cross right there on that culvert or that whatever the farmer's done there, you know. But again, I'm still trying to get near those dumps, you know. It's funny, they don't dump the big dead Holsteins in them very often unless the rendering plant doesn't come, and they're usually full of calves. And they may be two calves, it may be 30. But whatever number it is, any coyote on that farm is going to check it out all the time. And if we could use snares in this state, there's some wonderful locations around these calf dumps, because the farmers always try to hide them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just have them out in the middle of fields, you know, so they'll be down in a ravine, or they'll be back in these hedgerows or around these old hay bales and rotten bales type stuff. And oh my gosh, the coyote trails that are coming into them, and other animals obviously use them too, but I remember from your book, I was like, oh man, someone else is doing this too. I blindset a lot of coyotes. Not when I say a lot, I've caught a lot of coyotes in blindsets. It's I don't have to do that, but it's around those dumps. It can be a really, you know, mm-hmm. it can be a real good way to nail them. And I just pound in a bed and barely cover it with grass and throw them on a drag, because I want to keep that set going. And I love catching them in blind sets. It seems like every coyote catching a blind set's got a really stupid look on his face. Like, I can't believe I fell for that. You know,
you want to get me excited when I'm coyote trapping at home. We used to be agriculture, and then they said the erosion was too bad, so they got everybody in the dairy business, and then the small dairy businesses like we had went out of business, so there's not really anything like that there. A couple of guys still plant corn, but that's about it. But for blind setting, I'm in a big valley. It's like 4 miles long and wide, but it's like 60 miles long. So you definitely have barriers. And then right in the middle of it is a big road. So, you know, everything's concentrated, and the water runs up and down the valley, and we call it a river, but it's just a really big creek.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the bridges are made, especially on the new roads, there's like 4 or 5 feet of land underneath the bridge where the coyotes and deer and everything go under the thing. So I just go in there, and because it floods, you get the sand up there. It's really easy to blind set. You can see the trails. I mean, Ray Charles can see them. And you put them in there, and I've learned to run this 16-gauge baling wire on both sides of that trail to keep a spook a deer off of it, but a cow just walks right under it.
Sure.
And it's just bam, 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 bam. And I really think more trappers will have more fun if they blind set, because you don't ever know what you're going to catch, and that's the cool part about using them.
Yeah, it's fun. I really enjoy it. And, you know, it's a small percentage of my sets, relatively speaking, but every year I catch 10, 12, 15 coyotes and blind sets out of my 100 and whatever, and it's always fun. And I don't know, you know, sometimes I think maybe I wouldn't have caught them in a traditional set. You know, I don't know. It's hard to say, but it's a different twist.
What's your density on a farm?
Usually one family group. You know, I trap early enough in the year where I don't get to enjoy dispersal or, you know, any kind of migration. So some of these bigger operations that I have, when I go back there in January, there's clearly two or three family groups on it. But in the fall, it's pretty rare for me to have more than one. So I'm pup trapping. You know, I'm family group trapping and down the road. So, you know, I'd have to go back through my notes, but when I trap a farm and I'm only there for 7 or 8 days, I run two different loops, and they all end up back at my house. And there's a time where I'm sharing two legs of that one loop when I'm setting up the second loop. So there are farms that I trap for 3 weeks. And when I it's not a coincidence, therefore, that those farms that I trap for 3 weeks are the ones I catch 12, 13, 14 on. I'm just there longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly more than one family group. And they're good farms, big dairy operations, big dead piles. But I'm a cream of the cropper type guy. I remember in your book you said, you know, set every single location. And I think that was more from a nuisance standpoint. Mm-hmm. Catch every coyote. I'm the opposite of that. I want the dumb ones. I want the young ones.
For fur trapping, you're much better off.
I am. And I always say, you know, new places and new faces. And I'm not trying, as much as every farmer begs me to catch every coyote on their property, A, I'm not doing it, and B, I don't even know if sometimes it's possible. But what happens with us, and I'm sure you've seen it, Clint, where I pull in and I set a spot up and I bang them quick. I'll catch three or four, and it just goes dead like that. That location goes dead. That doesn't mean a mile away it's dead, but right there. And that's when I know I'm better off getting down the road and setting those same two or three traps on another group and catching three or four or five and down the road. So if I get lucky enough to anchor the old lady first, then that's a different story, but that just doesn't happen enough for me to count on it.
So what's your density on traps? Are you a heavy setter?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it's all sign related. If I go to if I'm trapping near a calf dump and there's trails beaten in, there's bones scattered all over the place, that might be a 7 or 8 trap location.
Okay.
But the traditional, you know, travel location with, you know, a little bit of sign or just a place I've been trapping for 25 years, I know I'm going to catch them there. You know, it's a 2, maybe a 3, but it's always 2. And the better locations will have 5, 6, 7, or 8, you know. And I've had several quads and lots of triples, countless doubles, obviously. But I don't pull in and see 8 coyotes spinning, you know. I'm not that good. I think it doesn't mean they're not there. I just haven't done that yet, you know.
In reality, very few people are.
Yeah,
well, and it's not so much the trapper, it's the coyotes.
Right, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be closing up. So what is your words of wisdom? But and the reason I always want to ask somebody this, I can see on the internet that, you know, like, we're kind of like in the circle of trapping. We know everybody in the industry, and you know them and whatever. But with the way the internet and Facebook and social media, you've got all of these younger guys now. I mean, like 12 and 14. I got 12 years old calling me asking business questions about trapping.
Right.
I mean, I love it.
Right.
You know, and you know, they're getting in and they hear all this stuff. So to a younger trapper, what would your words of wisdom be for coyote trapping?
You know, I'd say there's no silver bullet other than hard work, and I tell guys all the time, I alluded to it when I was earlier talking about the fox trap when I was a kid. You know, someone said a long time ago, and it makes a lot of sense to me, traps and miles. And with coyotes, I think that really plays out. And I think when guys don't have confidence, especially the younger guys, they go out back and they set four or five traps. And I tell those guys, set 40, set 50, play the averages. You know, catch one dumb one, you know, out of your 50 traps versus, and start to build on that confidence. I think they're pensive about doing just that. And I don't think it's even, I mean, these kids have, for some reason, have the money to buy this really nice equipment and lots of it, you know. So get out. I always tell guys, set more traps than what you're doing and play the odds, you know. And, you know, they get easier after your first 100, you know. So start catching that first 100, you know. And I think, you know this better than anybody. We can't teach these guys hard work. I do these demos every year, and I see the same guy sitting in the front row thinking I'm going to tell him something different this year. And I have showed them some different things, and I gradually peel back the onion and show them some different things, but I just can't teach these guys to work hard, and I can't teach them to be driven and focused. And for some reason, you know, you go out to Illinois or Indiana, and if we start talking to all these trappers that we know, we could probably come up with 20 or 30 guys that we know busted 100, 150 coyotes. Mm-hmm. Around here, it's just, I'm the only guy, and I'm not the best trapper in the world. What is it? You know, these guys, I think, just aren't willing to put the time in and the effort, and maybe they don't have that drive, that spark that a few of us have, you know. But at the end of the day, there should be guys around here catching 50 or 60 or 70. Mm-hmm. And that's not even happening, you know. It's you go from the guy that catches 10 to 160, and I just think
I personally think just as Americans and technological advanced as we are, we overanalyze everything, like, because. If you tell someone to go put in 50 traps to catch a coyote, first thing, well, that's a terrible catch percentage. Well, you ain't never caught one yet, so don't worry about what your catch percentage is.
Right, exactly.
You know, what's the percentage of flat sets to dirt holes and urine post sets? And you make it so complicated. Like, I do a lot of gardening. You get on YouTube, how you grow a tomato? There's 50,000 different ways to grow a tomato, and every one of them's right, and they all try to tear it, just like in trapping, and you're looking at that going, you got to be kidding me. It's a freaking tomato. It wants to live. Just let the thing live.
Yeah. You know, I think I could ask some very specific questions during my demos that, you know, I'm thinking to myself when the guy asks, is this really what you're worried about? You know, it's the old, how many inches back are you? How many over? And those kind of questions, I understand why people ask them, but I get asked that all the time. And they focus on those little types of things. And, yeah, they're important. But when I think I go out of my way to give them a very flippant answer. Like, you know, whatever the set dictates to me that day, I'm kind of, I don't know, 10, 9, depends. You know, I start digging, and boy, I hit a rock, I move over an inch. You know, there's no rules in my mind that are, I always say, I never say always and never, except for a few, very few things with coyotes. But I think the guys, you're right, they overanalyze this type of stuff, and they just don't want to get out there and swing the hammer and throw dirt, which is what I think they need to do over a big area.
There's a guy from Pennsylvania, I can't remember his name, he has glasses, and he goes to Maine and traps, or used to a lot, and has a mustache. Kind of looks 70-ish still, you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I know exactly who you're talking about. I'm trying to, his name escapes me.
And he gave a demo, and I happened to be walking by, and I got so intrigued in his demo, because apparently something has happened where he's had a bunch of questions. So he did a demo on it, doesn't matter. Where's your trap go? Doesn't matter. Which way is the jaws go? Doesn't matter. How big? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Put traps in the ground. It doesn't. That's what he said through the. And people were getting really frustrated. They kind of got what he was.
Right.
You know, to use wax and dye or speed, doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, just go trapping.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's. I think when people come to the demo, they probably expect a little more than that. But that point should resonate with them, and they should recognize what he's really saying. You know, and don't overthink it. Don't overanalyze it. But now I think these guys, just especially the newer guys, you know, they just have to get out over a bigger territory and look at more traps every day. And at the end of the day, when you come home and you say you caught 3 coyotes, it doesn't matter how many traps you caught that.
That's right.
I caught 3 coyotes. If I told you I caught 183 coyotes last year, if I told you my catch percentage, you wouldn't remember that. I wouldn't remember it. I remember the 183, though. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, it gets to how many you haul to the fur buyer. And I get, you know, people are going to try to save money and you know, the dream is every trap's got a coyote in it, but that's just not coyote trapping, right? it's not for me. It's not. It's a game of percentages, and I know some very good coyote trappers from the Midwest that, you know, when I tell them I'm looking at 100 traps to bring home 7 or 8 coyotes, they think that's dismal. But to me, that's kind of normal, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm just used to that. And
that's about what it's like in Tennessee.
Yeah, you know, and I'm okay with that, you know. This isn't muskrat trapping where you set 24 traps and take 18 muskrats out day one. You know, it's, and that's why I think I'll be okay with mink trapping. You know, mink trapping is kind of a similar...
You're training your patience.
Exactly. You know, I think, you know, trappers, the guys with the right mindsets, we're eternal optimists. When I have bad days, I said, that means tomorrow can only be better.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get them today, you know. You have to look at it that way.
Well, all right, man, I appreciate it.
It was fun.
You did a good job.
Thank you.
I could tell from you, you had a lot of energy yesterday.
Yeah.
I do have to tell you one thing I thought was funny about your demo before we go. I was only there like the last minute, and... the younger guy that was sitting up on my left, if you remember,
that's probably Cody. Yeah,
he. You're talking. Someone asked you a question on trap placement, and you know you're explaining how you thought they come in, and I'm just listening because I've never seen one of your demos. I'm just listening to what you had to say, and he leans over and he goes, "What do you think about that trap placement?" And I go, "Well, for pups, he's right on." You know, I mean, because that's where the pups, that's exactly what the pups do. And he goes, well, he's a pup trapper. I'm like, he's rocking then.
I got to tell you, I wish I could catch nothing but pups. Their furs are better. Mm. They're you know, our pups here in New York are extra large on the fur market. I mean, our coyotes are, you know, do I catch 50-pound coyotes? Yes. Is every one a 50-pound? No. I mean, I'll go years where I catch 150 coyotes and none of them break 50. But I got a lot of 45s and 47s. Mm-hmm. But I'll take a pup every day of the year. That's my program. Again, when I got the barn wall picture with 183, who cares how many are fucking pups?
That's
excuse
right.
my friend. Versus adults. You know, I'm not getting paid extra
for it. Because you're not control work.
No.
You're not worried what they're eating.
No.
You're just worried what they're selling for.
Correct.
And their fur is better. I mean, they're
far better. It's soft. You know, even these, you know, we have these coarse, dark coyotes up here, but there's a huge difference between the pups. And I think the pups that I catch around here fetch my best prices. If, you know, if that ends up being, you know, I want more than less every year, just like anybody would, but it doesn't deter me from trapping if the prices are in the toilet. They've been in the toilet more than they've not been for coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well,
I've never
just like
had
beaver. A 35-pound beaver always looks better than a 70-pound beaver.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd much rather catch 35-pounders than 70-pounders.
Right. You know, but no, it's funny that Cody asked that because he actually rides with me and he's seen firsthand what I do and he's been with me a few times. He's been with me on some 12 and 13 day coyotes. You know, those are fun days. You know, if I'm averaging 7 or 8 a day, you know, the days of 13 and 14, you need them to keep your averages going, but they're fun. You know, I enjoy it. I've had my best day in New York really the only place I trapped. I caught 18 2 years ago. And I caught, first check, I caught 10. And then the night that Hurricane Sandy came through, the night before that, something happened with the barometer. And you know, I had the traps out and I was ready for them. I didn't know that was going to happen. And I caught 18, and that's too many. I remember Matt Jones said one time, and I never understood it, and he's right. He goes, when I catch less than 6 or more than 10, I'm pissed. And that's about dead on. That is, and when I catch less than 6, I'm pissed. And when I catch more than 10, I'm not really thrilled. I mean, I'm happy, but sometimes you're pulling like, man, I hope I don't have another one. Boom.
The weight of what's getting ready to happen is in the back of your mind,
right,
even when you're excited about seeing them.
Yeah, a guy was telling me last night that Kip Feroz there, the guy that has turkey calls, he told me he has a skinner. I said, you son of a gun. How'd you figure that out? Hey, I said, do you know how many coyotes I could catch if I didn't have to worry about skinning them? Because what happens with me is, you know, sometimes in the fall we've got some 60-degree days, you know, the opposite of the inclement weather days. But you have 12 or 13 coyotes and 2 fox and 5 coon in the back of that truck, it wears on your mind. And it's hard to get out of the truck and put in 5 new sets or 10 or 15. It's hard. You got to – that, and that's probably one of those differences that, you know, a guy rode with me a few years ago and I was pulling traps – he rode me the day before my last check. And we pulled into a spot and I had 2 traps. And I had a possum and a trap. Took care of the possum and got my remake equipment out. He goes, aren't you pulling these tomorrow? I go, yeah. I can't catch, you know, the old adage. But I remade that set. And that blew his mind that I remade that set. I had one good one still working there. I said, well, if 2 or 3 come in, I need to be ready for them. And it didn't work out. I remember this because I didn't catch anything the next day. But you got to remake them, right? You know, and that little extra bit, that work, that if I have a weakness, sometimes I really got to push myself. You know, you ever drive by a set and you see a little bit of the jaw exposed and you're like, oh, you just want to go, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you don't fix that, you know, I'm not saying they're going to avoid that, but little things, you know, pan cover exposed or whatever it is, you know, and you gotta work your line. And that can be one of the biggest challenges, you know?
We always have to do motivational talks in Texas because when we're running, you know, some of those ranches, we're literally running a 70-mile snare line. And that's, you know,
look at the fences.
Yeah, 70 miles. Just think about how far 70 miles is from here, and you're looking at that every day. You get a bunch of wind, and a jackrabbit hits it, and you know, and we're talking hundreds of snares you're looking at in a day's time, and your head's out the window, and you see the flag, and you look. You see it bounced off the lock a little bit. First week, you hop out, put it back on. By about week six, you're like, yeah, that may work. get out of the truck. Get out of the truck, you know. You go there, fix it, and you really got to stay on that.
Yeah, you do.
Because if you don't, your numbers start crashing.
Right, and you know, and I think to myself, I have trouble focusing for 3 weeks. I can't imagine trapping for 6 months, you know, and keeping that focus. And, you know, guys always say, you know, if I lived where Mark Zagger does, I'd catch the coyotes. I, you know, that's BS to me. And I never think I could be the next Phil Brown and catch 1,100 fox if I lived in PA or whatever it is, because I don't know what it's like to trap for 6 months. I've never done it. Or 3 months. I don't know that I... Maybe it wouldn't be as much fun for me, you know? My 3 weeks is a marathon. It's a sprint, though, and a marathon mix. You know, I prepare all year for those 3 weeks, and I'm pretty much done. Mm-hmm. Maybe I would have a whole different mindset as far as my pace if I knew I had to make that last for 3 months, you know? And I'm running. You know, guys ride with me. They're like, you don't stop at diners. You don't stop for anything. I have all my food in the truck. If I stop for gas, that's even rare. I always gas up the last thing before I get home. Even if I only need a quarter tank, I have to gas up, you know? And I get all that out of the way. And I said, if you're riding with me, you know, if you have to go to the bathroom, I'll let you out. But we're not stopping. This is not a social, you know, we're going. I got only so many hours in the day. And, oh, my farm.
You wouldn't be able to do that for 6 months.
No, you can't. And you gotta slow down and take some time off and kind of probably regroup, you know. But 3 weeks I can pull it off, you know. But
what you would find out at probably 70% of that speed you could do for 6 months.
Yeah.
And you've got to go that way, but you just have to be very efficient on the way you do your body. You know, people ask me all the time, well, why do you use drags? You know, when I did the year-long Blitzkrieg video, what most people don't know is before I left Texas on the second time down that year, I had to start taking cortisone shots in my elbow from swinging a hammer.
Oh.
You know, it took almost a year to get that straightened out. I hate hammers.
I guess
that was painful, you know, and yeah, I could go and do that every year, but do I really want to be taking shots in my elbows? It didn't feel good just to put a stake in. No, I'll go 20 feet and get my coyote, thank you.
It's funny to say, because, you know, my job, it's certainly not a physical job, so I lead a relatively sedentary lifestyle outside of the trapping thing. I mean, I'm active, but I don't have a workout regimen. Every year I swear I'm going to get in better shape for trapping season, but I've had the same thing happen. It's tennis elbow, and you get that shot of cortisone right here. Oh, my gosh.
And it hurts.
Oh, that shot is I don't know who invented that needle and they spin that thing around. I've had them in my shoulders too, and it's the same thing. And it's because I don't prepare, and I don't do that all the time. And that gripping and the you know, setting the traps and the skinning, all of a sudden I damage it. You know, and those cortisone shots is. I go into it's like they're pulling an arrow out of me, the old West. I bite on the tongue depressors. I'm like, all right, give it to me. But it's worth going through because it numbs you. After that first day of that pain, it numbs you, and you can swing through it. That's why they give them to these football players, you know, during the Super Bowl, to get them through that last quarter. You know, makes sense. But, no, my hat's off to anybody that makes big catches. You know, guys talk about, you know, you see a guy with 1,000 raccoons in Iowa, and these guys are like, yeah, if I live there, I'd catch it. No, don't say that. That's insulting to that guy. That guy's killing himself. You don't even know what it's like to catch 100. How can you say you're going to catch 1,000? Yeah, it's nice to go to a spot where they're there. I get it. But to just in the most flippant of manners say that you could do it just because if you lived in the right spot, that's the difference right there. Because that you still have to find that one percenter. You know, not everybody in Iowa catches 1,000 raccoons.
No, I mean, I'll tell you an honest story about me. When I went out there and stayed at Red's, you know, I'd go to West Tennessee and different places, and I'd road trap. You know, don't have near the numbers. I'm doing 18 coon a day, you know. I'm hearing all these numbers out in Iowa, you know, I've been called 1,000 beaver, you know, so my brain's in the place for numbers way more at that time than it is now. So I talked to Red, and, well, you know, yeah, come out. I won't tell you where I'm sitting, but I'll show you kind of the routes. And I'm going to Maine to trap Martin, but you can, you know, use my skinning machine in the fur shed. And so my brain automatically went, if they're catching 1,000, by God, I can catch 1,000.
Sure.
Clint didn't catch 1,000. Clint didn't catch 500. You know, they said, we're catching 1,000 in 10 days to 2 weeks. I can catch 1,000 in 10 days because there's coon everywhere.
Right.
No.
They're in, I think Johnny Thorpe said it's hard to buck a good trapper in his backyard. You know, those guys have it down, right? And it'd be like, if you moved here, you're a good trapper and you could catch coyotes in numbers like I do, but it'd take you a while to get set up, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I got these farms, I know right where I'm going. I know right where I'm set when I pull in. When you go in new, it takes a few years to get, you know, mm-hmm. if you went back 2 or 3
which
years.
Which is part of the reason, because I travel so much, I set so many traps.
Right.
I don't have that learning. Because if someone's paying you, they're not going to go. So you're going to come back for 3 years, and by then you're going to... No. I mean, that's the reason I may have 1,800 acres with 80 traps.
Right. You got to catch everyone. That's your job.
And I don't know where they're at.
Right, right.
So, yeah, they could be here. Trap. They could go to that deer trail. Trap.
Yeah. Blitzkrieg them, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate it. I really do.
I enjoyed it. You know, I haven't really gotten to know you over the years, so maybe this will be the impetus for that, you know, and I'll certainly tune in and start checking things out, but I appreciate it. It's cool.
There will never be a point in your time, in your life, where it's the right time to do a great thing. If you're waiting for that perfect moment, that perfect timing, it's not going to happen. You know what you have to do? You have to create the perfect time and the perfect opportunity and the perfect situation.
die. Die! Why won't you die? Why won't you die?
Beneath this mask, there is more than flesh. Beneath this mask, there is an idea, Mr. Creedy. And ideas are bulletproof.